Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
My name is Nathan Hobson. I'm a host for the New Books in East Asia podcast series, part of the New Books Network. Thanks for joining us. Today, we're going to be talking about Japan at the Crossroads, Conflict and Compromise After Ampo by Nick Kapoor. This book is out from Harvard University Press this month, August 2018. It's an ambitious look at the transformations of Japanese society after the massive protests against renewal of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty in 1960. And that security treaty is what is abbreviated as Ampo in the title. Ampo was renewed despite 15 months of protest involving an estimated 30 million people in Japan. That's about a third of the total population at the time. The treaty was rammed through by the government of Kishinobusuke, but Kapoor argues that the aftermath fundamentally changed Japan in complex ways that we really haven't fully reckoned with. His narrative begins with political changes, both at home and in the U.S.-Japan relationship, but the book, in a very holistic way, addresses the economy, society, the labor movement, literature, the arts, mass media, conservative establishment, the police, the courts, and even the revitalization of right-wing forces like the Yakuza. Kapoor argues that the sometimes violent and ultimately failed protests against Ampo helped to delegitimize extra-parliamentary protest and ushered a turn toward the depoliticization of public society. To my mind, most provocatively, he challenges the idea of the so-called 1955 system of one-party conservative rule under the Liberal Democratic Party. And he argues instead that 1960 was the real landmark moment in the creation of a broader Ampo system, or post-Ampo system, I guess, that is the book's subject. Okay, so Nick, thanks for being here. And I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and about the project, how you ended up doing this.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me. So this project started as my PhD dissertation at Harvard University, where I was working with Andrew Gordon and Akira Irie. And what got me really started on this project, which of course is about the 1960 Ampo protests in Japan against the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty, was when I first read about these protests. And of course, these protests were massive, arguably the largest popular protests in Japanese history. So they come up all the time in passing in all kinds of secondary literature. And when I first encountered these, probably as an undergrad, I was shocked at the size and scope of these protests, millions of people across Japan taking part in various types of protest activity over more than a year from 1959 to 1960. And when you go to Japan today and walk on the streets of Tokyo or another large city in mainland Japan, it's really hard to even imagine protests of that kind of scale and intensity occurring in present-day Japan. Of course, the glaring exception being Okinawa, where anti-U.S. protests are still quite common, relatively speaking. So I really was just personally curious to understand how these protests came about, how they became so large, and how we got to where we are today, where such massive protests seem not very likely in the Japan of the present era. And maybe that's starting to change a little bit. We've seen some larger protests in recent years against this security bill that Prime Minister Abe passed a few years back, some anti-nuclear protests in the wake of the 2011 disasters. But at least at the start of my project, my personal journey, those things were still in the future. And so I really wanted to understand how we got from then, 1960, to now, the early 21st century, and what changes occurred in between to make this kind of massive protest seem less and less likely over time. And of course, you can't really cover all those 5 or 6 decades in one book. And so I really looked at the immediate aftermath of the protests in the early 1960s to see what started to change and what transformations were already taking place right in the first several years after these protests.
Yeah, thank you. And I think that this is really interesting for me because I think it leads very nicely into what I was trying to figure out exactly, what is the main argument here. And I think this leads really nicely into that, which is your feeling that 1960 represents this kind of moment of a seismic shift, a sort of existential moment for Japan. And I actually thought one of the most provocative things you said, and I wonder if we could sort of start here, is Japanese historians talk a lot about the 1955 system. But you make the suggestion that sort of common sense interpretation needs to be reexamined, and maybe it's better to think about an Anpo system. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what the 1955 system is, or what it's generally conceived to be, and then why you think that that's maybe not the right way to think about it, and what you think would be a better way to consider the post-war history of Japan.
Sure, yeah. I think you've really hit the nail on the head there and got sort of to the core of the argument that I present in this book. I'm really trying to understand post-war and contemporary Japanese history in a more holistic manner, which would mean integrating cultural history, social history, and political history. And the 1955 system, which, as you mentioned, is widely talked about in terms of Japanese political history, refers to the unification of the conservative Liberal Party and Democratic Party in 1955 to form the Liberal Democratic Party. And then the corresponding unification in response to that of the left and right halves of the Socialist Party. The Japan Socialist Party had had an earlier schism, and they were so fearful of this united conservative party that they were forced to reunite in a kind of unhappy marriage in 1955 in reaction to that. And so just thinking purely in terms of political parties and literally the names of the political parties and when they start, people felt it was convenient to call this the 1955 system. And why is it a system? Well, the Liberal Democratic Party went on to rule almost continuously with a couple of very short breaks from 1955 until now. So just in sort of looking at it from a superficial level of the names of the parties and the party that happened to be in charge for a long time, it seemed like 1955 was a big turning point. But what I'm trying to do in my book is think more holistically, not just in terms of political parties, but in terms of what's going on in Japanese society. And a lot of the changes that I'm charting in this book, they start in the aftermath of these huge protests in 1960. And so the sort of unified picture of what's going on doesn't really make sense if you start in 1955. The 50s, as I argue in the book, were a decade of increasingly vitriolic and intense clashes between left and right in Japan over the future of Japan as a nation, what kind of direction it was going to take on the international scene, but also domestically, especially within the context of the global Cold War. And this conflict just keeps escalating over the course of the 1950s and culminates, I argue, in these massive protests in 1960. And so to start the story of what Japanese society is going to look like after this massive protest movement in 1960. In 1955, when things are still escalating and ramping up, doesn't make so much sense. And so I think we need to move the turning point in post-war Japanese history forward a few years to the aftermath of these protests.
That's not only, I think, a great summary of sort of what I also saw as the argument. I think that was really clear. But it also, you touched on the fact that you're trying to do this more sort of holistic history in which you're integrating political and socioeconomic and cultural histories. And I thought that was a really interesting contribution to the way that we think about, you know, post-war Japan as you know, as a system in that sense. So, Nick, I think that it seemed to me the book was sort of split into more or less two sections, in which the first section you really talk about the political fallout of the 1960 protests. And then in the second half of the book, you sort of shift gears and really get into that much more holistic view of the fallout from 1960. So I wonder if we could talk a little bit about the first half of the book, which is the political changes. You start off in chapter one talking about the change in Japan's international position, particularly the U.S.-Japan relationship. And I loved what you said, you know, right up at the at the opening of this. You say that U.S.-Japan relations during the Kennedy and Ikeda administrations in the 1960s have been largely ignored, thanks to a perception that nothing of great import happened between the two nations in the early 60s. But you're pushing back pretty strongly on this. I wonder if you could tell us about that.
Yeah, so chapter one is really a revisionist history of U.S.-Japan relations in the first half of the 1960s during the John F. Kennedy and Ikeda Hayato administrations. And as you just quoted, the prevailing historiography of this before my book has really been that nothing much happened. So, of course, you do have some reaction to these massive protests, which were widely perceived as having an anti-American character. And so John F. Kennedy takes over as the U.S. president. One of the first things he does is he sends Edwin O. Reischauer, a Harvard University professor of Japanese studies, to Japan as the U.S. ambassador to Japan. And this was an interesting move because typically in the past, the United States had sent career diplomats to Japan, and Japan had been seen as a plum posting. And so a lot of these career diplomats in the State Department sort of worked their whole career hoping to land such a posting as Japan and were kind of annoyed when this academic was sent instead. But this was a move by the Kennedy administration to send somebody who had local expertise. Previous diplomats sent to Japan didn't even necessarily know Japanese. Reischauer knew Japanese. He was married to a Japanese woman. And so this was a move that made waves at the time. And later historians have recognized that this was an attempt to soothe over hard feelings in Japan toward the United States. But this has mostly been portrayed as largely symbolic, or anything that Reischauer said was just rhetorical. Reischauer famously talked constantly of creating an equal partnership between Japan and the United States, implying that what had come before was less than equal. But political scientists pointed out that the relationship remained unequal in many ways, others pointed out that Eisenhower had spent a lot of effort to try to connect with Japan. And so this moment in U.S.-Japan relations and the history of that relationship was, for the most part, skipped over in textbooks on the history of U.S.-Japan relations, or it got at most a few paragraphs. And then people sort of jumped ahead. And there are certain canonical events in the history of U.S.-Japan relations that you pretty much always have to mention. And there are a lot of those in the 50s. So, of course, there's the peace treaty that ends the war between the United States and Japan in that's officially comes into effect in 1952 after a conference in San Francisco in 1951. There's a variety of anti-base protests in Japan. There's the Lucky Dragon incident in the mid-1950s when a U.S. nuclear test leads to fallout that lands on a Japanese fishing boat, and they all get sick, and one of the fishermen died. And so that started a large anti-nuclear movement in Japan. There's a variety of other incidents. In 1957, a U.S. soldier named William Gerard shoots a woman, a Japanese woman, collecting scrap metal on a Japanese military base. And so the typical history of U.S.-Japan relations tends to go through all these events in the 50s. And then, of course, mentions the huge protests in 1960, maybe says something about Ambassador Reischauer getting sent over, and then sort of skips ahead until 1969, even the Okinawan reversion, in which the United States ceded control of Okinawa back to Japan, although they kept large amounts of it to this day for military bases. And then into the 1970s, where you have another series of events between the U.S. and Japan. And so almost the whole decade of the 60s tends to get skipped over. And so what I was trying to do in chapter one is rethink what actually happened during the Kennedy and Ikeda administrations. Looking at government documents, I think I was able to show rather convincingly that in addition to the rhetoric of equal partnership, serious efforts were made to actually make the partnership more equal. And in particular, the Kennedy administration, at Reischauer's urging, really took steps to treat Japan as an ally rather than as a sort of subordinate, dependent client state. And so there was a rhetorical move to do so, but also an attempt to do so in actuality. And so President Kennedy actually started sending secret messages to Prime Minister Ikeda before he announced major announcements relating to U.S. foreign policy and the Cold War policies toward the Soviet Union. So, for example, prior to the Cuban Missile Crisis, he sent a notification to Ikeda telling Ikeda in advance that he was going to make this announcement to the world about the missiles in Cuba. And he did this at a variety of other junctures as well. And so this really started a pattern of informing Japanese leaders in advance before making announcements. And this was the kind of treatment that the U.S. was giving to close allies at the time, such as Great Britain. And so Japan was brought into this Cold War battle as a much more equal standing, more like an ally than a client state.
Yeah, and I think this, I think that's a really important reframing, because as you point out, we talk about the 50s as being very political, and the 70s as being political again, but the 60s seems, you know, other than the Anpo protests in 1960 itself, it's so depoliticized in the way that we talk about it. And I think it's a really good introduction to sort of what the first half of your book is trying to do, is bring back that political narrative, right? I mean, we talk about the, you know, Olympics, we talk about the Shinkansen, we talk about GDP, and sort of all of the economics, and we talk about the social transformations, but they're taken out of that political context too. So this is, I think, one of the nice things that you're doing in this, you know, holistic way about the in the book, to bring those together. But the first half of the book, as we've said, you know, is really about what happens politically. And so I wonder if we could move on to chapter two, because in chapter two you're moving away from the international situation and getting into the domestic. And chapter two is about the stabilization of conservative rule. And in many ways, that's about the collapse. In chapter three, you talk about the collapse of the opposition. But in chapter two, you're talking about the firming up of the majority, the challenges at home, the response to those challenges in the 1960s. So I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about the Prime Minister, Ikeda Hayato, who's sort of the protagonist of this chapter, and the challenges that he faced and how he dealt with them domestically.
Yeah, so that's a good place to start. He faced a lot of challenges, and this gets back to your earlier question about why should we call this a Anpo system or 1960 system instead of a 1955 system. And I think the crucial starting point for chapter two is the fact that these huge protests were a disaster for the ruling party, the Liberal Democratic Party, the conservative party that was in power. Of course, in a sense, these protests are often seen as a failure, a failed protest, especially by people on the left, because their stated goal was to prevent the renewal of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty and end the U.S.-Japan Military Alliance. And obviously that didn't work out. We still, of course, the United States still has military troops on Japanese soil to this day. But they were a success from the perspective of the left in that they brought down the government of this hated Prime Minister Kishi Nobusuke, who had a long and sordid history. He'd served in the Tojo Hideki cabinet in World War II. He'd been a bureaucrat in the Japanese colony of Manchuria. He was indicted after the war as a Class A war criminal and only escaped prosecution because there was a reverse course in U.S. occupation policy, and he was depurged and let back into government and had this sort of comeback, and it took him 10 years, but he rose to become Prime Minister of Japan. But people were always suspicious of Kishi on the left especially, but also in the center and on the right as well, that he had this war criminal past, and was he really going to take Japan back to some kind of pre-war system? And so he was a real hated figure by many people in Japan, and he's forced to resign as a result of these protests. And then the humiliation that accompanies his resignation is only magnified by the fact that he has to humiliatingly call off a planned visit by President Dwight D. Eisenhower that would have taken place in late June of 1960 on account of the massive protests. But of course, that visit had to be called off as a result of these massive protests. And so you have the double disaster for the Liberal Democratic Party, Prime Minister, the whole cabinet has to resign, and this planned visit by the U.S. president is called off. And then in the aftermath of that, the Liberal Democratic Party itself really almost comes apart. Various opposition factions in the party in the summer of 1960 make plans to split off from the party at the height of the protests, when they had forced the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty through the Japanese National Legislature. Several members of the ruling party had absented themselves from the vote because they were so angry at Prime Minister Kishi. And so you have all these schismatic forces within the Liberal Democratic Party. And so when Ikeda Hayato takes over in July of 1960, he's facing a party that's on the verge of falling apart. And so he has to figure out a way to get this party back together and get the country back together after this very divisive protest movement. And it was interesting that you mentioned how the 1960s have been often portrayed in historiography as not a very political era. And I think in a way that speaks to the triumph and the success of Ikeda's strategy, the solution he comes up with to try to address these various serious problems, which is to purposely try to turn the country and turn the national discourse away from politics towards economics, toward the Olympics, which is a big part of this plan, and get everyone back on the same page, focused around something that's not very political or perceived as not so political. And what he hits upon is economic growth. And so this is the reason that he announces with great fanfare in the fall of 1960, immediately after these protests, and the income doubling plan, right, which is sort of Japan's version of the John F. Kennedy moonshot that we're going to put a man on the moon. Within 10 years, Ikeda says we're going to double Japan's GDP. Within 10 years, and which will, and he put it in terms of income, your salary, that your salary is going to be doubled because the nation's GDP is going to be doubled by 1970. And of course, Japan succeeds ahead of schedule. It only takes them 7 years, not 10 years, to double the size of the national economy. And so Ikeda really works hard to rally people around these economic goals and sort of let's not pay attention anymore to these divisive political problems where Japan's going to be within the Cold War international structure. Let's focus on economic growth. And this has a long legacy. Even today, there's real unity in Japan around a lot of questions relating to economics, that Japan should be an economic superpower. People on the left and right have subscribed to this idea. And of course, Ikeda also, is really taking advantage of an economic growth process that's already happening at the time. And so historians have tended to discount the income doubling plan, again, sort of like with Reischauer's appointment as ambassador, is merely rhetorical, right? That he's sort of claiming credit for something that's already happening. Japan has tremendous post-war economic growth starting in the 50s. And so is he really doing anything different? But I argue in the chapter that Ikeda had a real insight here. He recognized what was happening, and then he was able to turn that into a propaganda victory that maybe is still affecting how historians describe this era to this day, as you point out. And I go through and I show how other people at the time were not so confident that Japan would be able to meet these targets. And so Ikeda and his advisors really had some insight that people at the time did not necessarily have.
Yeah, and I think this that really leads us very nicely into what you're doing in chapter 3, where you're talking about the collapse of the political resistance to Ikeda. But I think it's also important, you know, we've been having this nice back and forth about the collapse of the sort of politicization, sort of more generally, of the era, and at least the historical memory of it. I don't know if you're familiar, Ogama Eiji has talked about this idea of the 1970 paradigm, where he's sort of locating that, you know, by 1970, when the second round of protests fail, then this sort of plan that Ikeda has put, you know, Ikeda and the LDP have put in motion of depoliticizing economic growth. And essentially, if you, you know, get out of the universities and, you know, get out of the university protests and get out of, you know, protesting on the streets, we promise you endless economic growth and full lifetime employment. You know, Ogama is locating that at 1970, but I really like how you're sort of pulling that back into the process that's going on through the whole decade of the 1960s. And I think an important part of that process, as you point out in chapter 3, is the waning of the opposition parties, which is the title of the chapter. So if you could talk about how that fits into this larger picture that you're portraying here, that'd be great.
Yeah. So of course you have both sides, left and right, are faced with essentially the same problem, which is schismatic forces within these political parties. I already mentioned how the Socialist Party had this unhappy marriage between left and right, but the LDP, the ruling Conservative Party, had an unhappy marriage, in a sense, between eight competing factions. And these factions were united around their sort of personality cults formed around individual politicians and their Koenkai, their sort of local network of supporters. And these were ties of personal loyalty that had very little to do, if anything, with actual policy positions. And so in the LDP, people didn't really disagree on policy per se. It was just they had these factional rivalries and personal animosities between different factions. And it was a marriage of convenience to hold power. And they had a lot of tension between these factions, which almost led to a splitting up of the party. And so these protests are exacerbating these tensions within the LDP. Similarly, they exacerbate the tensions within the factions on the left and the left political parties. And these have to do with how should the left conduct these protests. Now, the difference between the left and the right is that the parties on the left, the factions, actually not only have all the same personal private animosities between different political factions within political parties, but they also have real policy disagreements. And so when they're trying to all team up together to conduct these protests in 1960, there are increasingly severe disagreements over what kind of protests should these be. Should we stick to a more doctrinaire Marxist ideology and make this into a socialist revolution? Should we try to make it a more broad-based movement and make alliances with others who may not be as committed to socialist revolution as we are? And it goes down this rabbit hole of these doctrinal debates. And actually, the Socialist Party re-splits in the middle of the protests into this Japan Socialist Party and the Democratic Socialist Party. And so they actually split in half. The LDP almost did that, but the Socialist Party actually splits in half. And then you have an ongoing process of schisms within the Socialist Party, also within the Communist Party as well, in the aftermath of these protests, as they argue over why the protests failed and who was to blame and what they should have done differently. And this Ikeda is able to capitalize on this as he's trying to shift the conversation to economic growth. He's able to portray these opposition parties as hopelessly out of touch. And he's able to make the promise that the rising tide is going to lift all boats, that economic prosperity is going to come for everyone. And so no need for a socialist revolution. Why don't you come over and support a more mainstream big tent party that he was able to mold the LDP into? And so he really solidified the LDP's rule. And then these left-wing parties increasingly became more and more relevant. I should add that another step that Ikeda took to really take the wind out of the sails of the Socialist Party in particular was that he explicitly disavowed any attempt in the future by the Liberal Democratic Party to revise Article 9 of the post-war Japanese Constitution, which is, of course, the article that permanently and forever renounces war or war-making capacity on the part of the Japanese state. And so this was a clause put in the Constitution by the United States when they were sort of handing Japan its new constitution in the immediate aftermath of World War II. And this Article 9 had been a source of intense disagreement in the 1950s. So conservatives had been pushing very strongly to get rid of this article and revive some type of military power for Japan. And in fact, Prime Minister Kishi, this hated prime minister who had to step down after the protests, had established a special committee to investigate how to get rid of Article 9. And so the LDP had really put its foot down or put a line in the sand that it was going to revise Article 9. Now, the process for revising the Japanese Constitution requires a two-thirds majority in the Japanese Diet, the national legislature. And so the Socialist Party was able to make a lot of hay out of this for anyone who favored keeping Article 9, that as long as they could keep a one-third level in the Diet, they could prevent that revision.
Yeah. And so I think that this takes us back actually to something I wanted to mention when we were talking about Kishi. Is, of course, he's the grandfather of the current prime minister, Abe Shinzo, who also has Article 9 in his sights. And so it's sort of, this is a, you know, an interesting thing where you're sort of in some ways seeing a breakdown of this Anpo system, which you've talked about its great influence, in the sort of post-war period. But of course, I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself, because in chapter 4, what you're talking about is the other part of the breakdown of resistance to the growthist sort of policies of the LDP and the attempt to prioritize growth and depoliticize the sort of political economy, I guess, of Japan. And that's what you call the collapse of the 1960 coalition. Could you tell us a little bit about what you mean by the 1960 coalition? And also tell us how that, if you can, how that relates to the waning of the opposition parties.
Yeah, so the 1960 protests were carried out by a broad center-left coalition of an extremely wide variety of political parties and various civic organizations of all different types. So you had, of course, the left-wing political parties. You had the left-wing labor unions, which was most of the labor unions at the time. You had a variety of anti-war groups. You had mothers' groups, women's groups, child protection groups, various types of proto-environmentalist groups, anti-nuclear bomb groups, even some business and farmers cooperatives. And so you had more than 100 of these groups nationwide, and they all come together in this overarching umbrella organization to oppose the revision of the security treaty starting in 59, and that goes into 1960. And this structure is very successful. So they're able to, through this pyramid organization that reaches all the way down to the lowest levels of these various organizations, mobilize very large-scale protests. And these groups had gradually gotten larger and more organized over the course of the struggles of the 1950s. And so in that sense, 1960 was really the culmination of this long experience of center-left protests over the course of the 1950s that climaxes with the largest protest in 1960. And so this is the coalition that I'm talking about in that chapter four. That served as the backbone of these protests. And so if we're asking the question, why don't we have such massive large-scale protests after 1960? Well, the answer becomes that this coalition completely falls apart. And not only do these groups have conflicts and schisms between each other, so after 1960, over the course of the protests, they come to disagree about what the protests are actually about. But within almost every single one of these constituent groups within the coalition, there's schisms and the groups split. So even the Nihon Hahaoya Taika, this Japan Mothers Society, which you would think is not so political, but they split into two versions, and one's backed by a certain left-wing faction, and another's backed by a different faction. And so all these groups start splitting up. And so in chapter four, I was looking at some examples of this. And so in particular, I was looking at how the labor movement really retreats from militant political action in favor of a more narrowly focused workplace action. And they sort of give up political strikes. And Ikeda really tries to woo them over to his side and with concessions on wages to get them to stop being so involved in politics. And then you have the student movement, which I think is sort of my example of the internal schisms within these organizations, where you had this large student organization nationwide at all the colleges and universities called Zengakuren, which heads into the 1960 protests very united and powerful, and comes out of it already split into three or four factions, and then it further splits into 30 or 40 tiny sub-factions over the course of the 1960s, and is never going to be able to be so powerful ever again. And then lastly, in that chapter, I look at these progressive intellectuals who had really given a sort of patina of intellectualism to these protests, and how they also are become disillusioned and have fights about what the protests actually meant. And most of the most prominent intellectuals who had supported the protests retreat from political activism over the course of the 1960s. And so this tells us something about the broader depoliticization of Japanese society. It's not just these intellectuals, of course. A lot of ordinary people or labor unionists or workers or members of these coalition groups are also retreating from political activism or giving up or feeling disillusioned and upset that the protests failed to stop the treaty. And so you have the rise of people calling themselves non-political in the 1960s, or nonpori in Japanese. They say, "I'm not political anymore." And then in the last part of that chapter, I actually looked at some people, a sort of younger generation of people who were, on the contrary, not depoliticized, but actually politicized by the protests. So you have really a tale of two generations. And this sort of leads into chapter five, which we'll talk about in a moment. But for an older generation, who had been active throughout the 1950s, fighting against the right and what they saw as a return to the pre-war system and pre-war militarism by this hated Prime Minister Kishi and the LDP. They feel the protests are a total failure, and so they sort of give up. They have this sense of, everyone talks about zasetsu, right, this sense of failure, and so they turn away from political activism. But for a younger generation, so high school students, undergraduates, this was their first chance to participate in protest activity, and it was such a large-scale protest that this was very exciting for them, and they felt very energized, and they carried forward this activism into the rest of the 1960s. And so I look at that in Chapter 4 as well, so I don't want to just present a sad story of collapse and schisms, but I also wanted to say, look, there were these other people who were very excited by these protests, and in particular, women felt very energized by the 1960 protests. For many women, it was the first chance that they ever had to march in the streets in protest of something, because previously women had not, almost never been allowed to do that, if ever. And so there's a direct line that a lot of women's rights activists, women's liberation activists draw between their activity in the later 1960s and in the 1970s, straight back to 1960. And so I kind of took them at their word that this was very exciting for them. And I presented some evidence of how these protests really helped women get started with political activism. And then, of course, the other groups also, there's residents movements that arise out of the 1960 movement. There's an environmental movement that arises out of it. But these movements are going to have to take different forms that cannot be so explicitly political, because in this new depoliticized rhetoric of the 1960s, you're going to have to find another way to justify why you're engaging in political activism. So it's going to be more focused around your apartment block, or it's going to be gendered in female terms that seem less threatening, or it's going to have to be an environmental movement that focuses very much on local consequences and is not going to engage with these hot button issues that had been so divisive in the early 1960s.
And so you said in this chapter that, you know, by the middle of the 1960s, that big coalition collapses. But, you know, as you're pointing out here, this sort of opened up the way for new types of social movements in Japan. And the other thing you talk about is opening up the title of Chapter 5, New Directions in Literature and the Arts. So I'd like to move on to that, which I think really begins a major shift, a new direction in your book as well, right? Which is getting away from this repoliticization, the political narrative, and talks about the literature, the arts, sort of gets into the second half of the book here. So you talk about new directions, major movements, works and artists. I'd like to sort of talk about those. But you're talking not a sort of epistemological break, but the acceleration of some existing tendencies that were also there, and the sort of both continuity and discontinuity in literature and the arts. And so I wonder if you could just sort of give us a picture of what was going on in the 1960s.
In the 1960s, specifically right around the year 1960, right around when these protests happened, you have an explosion of all kinds of new directions and new genres in the arts, in literature, in every genre. So there's a new school of photography, there's new types of modern dance, there's new types of theater, there's new types of visual art, there's new types of literature that are appearing on the scene. And so is it just coincidence that we have all these new types of art and literature and personal expression all of a sudden in 1960? Now, of course, if you go back into the 50s, you can see it's not as sudden of a break. As you alluded, this is not a total rupture or a total epistemological change. But a lot of the artists themselves really describe 1960 as a rupture. And a lot of literature specialists or art historians have looked back and seen a moment of rupture. I'm a little skeptical of that. I don't want to portray it as a total rupture. I do think these trends were already visible in the late 1950s, but you use the word acceleration, and that's the word I like to use as well. So that you start to see some shifts in the late 1950s, and these protests happen, and then these shifts are suddenly accelerated onto a fast track to a new type of art. And so the type of art and literature that we're seeing right away in the very early 1960s, already by the end of the year 1960, in fact, is quite recognizably different from what we'd been seeing just a year before or 2 years before, and across all different genres. And what allows this to happen, I argue, is that basically all of these artists and thespians and writers got wrapped up in these protests, and they were out in the streets. They were part of this coalition as part of their troops, or they had their own organizations of theater artists or writers or visual artists. And so they're marching in the streets. And so this is where I'm trying to get at more of the holistic picture. I know you argued that maybe there's two halves of my book, but I really see this as sort of the same sort of schisms that I'm talking about in the previous couple chapters are also happening within all these art groups as well. The same sort of debates, were the protests a success or a failure? Well, we didn't stop the treaty, so they were a failure, but other people feel, no, but we got rid of Kishi, so they were a success. How should we behave in the future? These are also percolating and within these artistic societies. And you have the same differing reaction between the two generations, the older generation who's maybe more disappointed and the younger generation who's more excited. Now, there's a backstory to this, which is that in post-war Japan in the late 40s and 50s, right after the war, all of these artistic genres and literature are really dominated by the Communist Party to an extent that's really hard to square with the actual numbers of artists who say they're members of the Communist Party. I mean, it's a lot, but even then, a lot of artists are not members of the Communist Party, but the Communist Party has this outsized influence because a lot of the leading lights, the most famous artists and writers, are members, and they have control over the artistic societies, which tend to be very hierarchical, and so they enforce on the art world and the literature world a vision of what art and literature should be, which is that it should be subordinated to politics, and in particular the politics of the Communist Party. So all art and literature should support the goal of fomenting a socialist revolution in Japan. And so the upshot of that is that you have an awful lot of socialist realism writing and art produced in the 1950s. And it does get a little weaker over the course of the 1950s, but even right on the eve of these security treaty protests in 1959, it's still remaining quite strong and very much the mainstream. And people are not quite able to break free of that. But over the course of these protests, as all these artists get involved, they get really angry with the Communist Party, because the Communist Party decides over the course of these protests that they are going to be as peaceful as possible. And they have this policy called passive dispersal. So they're not going to battle with police. They're going to participate, but they're not going to escalate anything. They're going to be as peaceful as possible. This has to do with the longer history of the Communist Party itself and some of their own missteps in the 1950s. But a lot of these artists felt, well, this was our chance to have a socialist revolution or a communist revolution, and the Communist Party is copping out. And so they get really angry, and this inspires a lot of them to break free of this socialist realist orthodoxy. And as I alluded to, you have this generational gap. So the older generation who'd really invested in socialist realism, they sort of give up on it. And so they turn away from it. But the younger generation, who was just starting to come to the fore around 1960, they were feeling the oppressive pressure to conform to this certain type of art or literature. And so they're excited by the protests. This is their chance to break free from it. And so you end up with both generations turning away from socialist realism and going in a much more personal and depoliticized direction.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you for in addition to giving a great sort of summary of the chapter, also for pushing back on my interpretation of the sort of two halves of the book. So in chapter six, which is the last chapter, you talk about another aspect of what you call in chapter six the landscape of expression. The chapter is reshaping the landscape of expression. In chapter five, literature and the arts, and you talk about the visual arts, you talk about theater, you talk about literature. And here in that same kind of, and I think this is a very provocative term, landscape of expression, you talk about the courts, the police, the mass media, and the Yakuza and other right-wing groups, and sort of how, in a sense, conservative backlash and the changed discursive field, the field of possible expression in a post-Ampo world or an Ampo order. Can you tell us a little bit about this chapter and also about how... I'm really curious personally, like it kind of took me off guard, this chapter, right? I mean, it was the chapter that surprised me most, and I found it a very pleasant surprise. So I'm curious sort of how you got into the idea of doing this particular chapter, in particular just sort of to round things off as the last chapter.
Okay, well, can I start by asking you what in particular you found surprising
in the sense
chapter?
That I was surprised to see the attention to the courts, the police, and the Yakuza. I wasn't, I guess, surprised, but in thinking about the mass media, I guess that was something that I was kind of expecting as I was reading through the book. Was okay, we've talked about the politicians, okay, we've talked about the students, we've talked about labor, we've talked about the artists, and I kind of felt like, okay, mass media must be in here somewhere. But I was really, I just thought this was a very clever thing that you've done here to bring in the courts, the police, and the sort of far right in Japan into this landscape of expression.
Yeah, so that's interesting because if you think back to what I talked about at the beginning, the reason I started this research was because I was driven by this question of how did we get from 1960 to where we are 50 or 60 years later, from these huge, massive protests where I estimate in the introduction that at least 30 million people participated in some kind of protest activity to where we are later on, where we don't see very large-scale protests in Japan. That was the driving question. And so I was just casting my net widely and trying to understand this question and its possible answers from as many perspectives as possible. So I knew I wanted to look at U.S.-Japan relations and Japanese domestic politics, these social movements, the labor movement, the students, the intellectuals, the artists. These were sort of the actors in the protests themselves, who were actually either out in the streets or opposing the protests. But then I had these other groups that I wanted to look at. You mentioned the media, but I wanted to look at right-wing groups because, as I describe in the introduction, these right-wing groups actually go out into the streets at the height of the protests and attack the left-wing protesters. So where did these guys come from and what were they thinking? The media was covering it and was blamed by both sides for exacerbating the protests. So what was their perspective? And then the police keep showing up again and again, whether they're fighting with the protests directly or trying to prevent right-wingers from doing damage. And so I had to decide, was this going to be, four separate chapters on the courts, the police, the media, and the right wing? So I ended up finding this common thread of freedom of expression. So you have all four of these groups, in the end, not entirely a conspiracy, but conspiring together, if only unwittingly, to, as you described it, drastically circumscribe, in my view, the landscape of acceptable expression. And I use that landscape word in a double sense. So there's a sort of metaphorical landscape of expression, where are the hills and valleys that you're allowed to go in terms of what you're allowed to say about the emperor in particular, but also the physical landscape. And so Tokyo, they're remodeling and renovating and upgrading Tokyo in anticipation of the 1964 Tokyo Olympics. And I argue this is an opportunity that the government takes to really close down the wide open public spaces in Tokyo in particular, which was often the center of these protests. And they do it in other cities later on, following the Tokyo model. So if you look at pictures from the 1950s of big train stations in Tokyo, Shinjuku, Shibuya, there's really broad open spaces where they had streetcars pulling in and out. And these are really chopped up and subdivided. And then there were other plazas that are cut by highways. And so they really closed down public space and just give people a lot less space to have large street protests. In front of the Diet, they put a huge median in the middle of the big road where all the protesters went before, and of course put police every 10 meters, which are still there today, to keep people away from the Diet. And so they're closing down physical space. And then, of course, the courts have a series of decisions in which they basically make it illegal to publicly protest without the permission of the police. The police develop new tactics to close down and defeat various types of protest marches that had been designed to occupy public space. The right wing, I argue in this chapter, really comes out into public view again in a way that they had not been in the first 15 years of the post-war period. There'd been a sort of stigma against ultra-rightism in the wake of this failed war, understandably. But the right wing really panics in 1960 that maybe this is a communist revolution and we need to come out again in public and fight against it. And so they're emboldened and empowered, and donations flow into their coffers. A lot of new right-wing groups are formed, and they're emboldened to such an extent that in the rest of the 1960s, you have a series of attempted assassinations, most famously a successful assassination in the fall of 1960 against the chairman of the Socialist Party, Asanuma Inejiro. There's this incredible photograph, which I have in my book, of him being assassinated on live TV by a sword-wielding right-wing youth. But you have a variety of other stabbings in particular that recalled a wave of assassinations in the 1930s by the right in the pre-war period. So the right wing really comes back into public view and is still in public view to this day. So getting back to the question of, you know, this Ampo system and what we're still living with nowadays, you know, public holidays, you see the right wing noise trucks on every corner. And so they've remained in public view ever since. And then sort of at the core of this chapter is my analysis of the mass media and really how you have a push and a pull. So the government, of course, is trying to make the media tone down its anti-government rhetoric, and they use advertisers and access journalism as a carrot to promote more favorable coverage. And advertisers are able to put pressure. Companies who tend to be conservative, large corporations, band together to make use of their advertising clout to get the kind of political coverage or lack thereof that they would prefer. But then also a real soul searching on the part of ostensibly left-leaning media. I focused especially on the Asahi Shimbun because that's perceived as being the most left of the major newspapers, where they do this hansei, this self-criticism or self-reflection, and decide that they're just going to proactively do more self-censorship. And they sort of openly talk about this, at least internally, that we need to not fan the flames of protests. We need to act in the service of social stability. And so I go through the process by which these newspapers went from a stance at the beginning of the protests that their main job was to speak truth to power, to a stance at the end of the protests that they should focus on social stability.
Yeah, I think that that point about the Asahi really rings true to me, and especially the vocabulary that you use there. You know, with the Japanese word hansei, which is often a little bit difficult to render into useful English. One of you, I jokingly have called hansei the, you know, the sort of the post-mortem. And I think that's, you know, in an interesting way, it fits into the way that you're using it here, right? This sort of the attenuation of any sense of, you know, that sort of open confrontational style of extra parliamentary protest against the growthism, against the sort of mainstreamed conservative agenda. And so I think that's a really nice way for us actually to wrap up today. I want to thank you for spending the time with us. And I just in closing, I'd like to ask you what you're up to these days with your book out. Are you resting on your laurels? Do you have a new project you're working on? What's going on?
Yeah, thank you so much again for having me on the podcast. And yeah, to answer your final question, I do have a lot of things on the horizon. I'm not just going to rest on my laurels. It feels really good to have the whole world in front of me all of a sudden after working on this book for 10 years. Of course, I quite enjoyed the book, but it's very exciting to have the whole world as my oyster, so to speak. I do have a few smaller articles which are related to this book project or sort of spin-off articles which I'm working on now. The one that's coming out the soonest is an article I just wrote for Japanese Studies, the journal in Australia, which is a special issue on the 100th anniversary, the centennial of the Meiji Restoration in 1968. So the government had a celebration, a year-long celebration of the 100 years from Meiji to 1968. And historians in particular became very upset about this. And they said this was glorifying the wartime era. And so they protested against that. And so I wrote an article about that, which is coming out this fall. I'm also writing an article about the history of the snake dance, which was a particular kind of protest march in Japan, developed in the early post-war period and used increasingly throughout the 50s and then used an incredible amount during the 1960 treaty protests, where people would link arms and form ranks of five or six people and then careen back and forth across the street like a snake. I actually have an incredible photograph, aerial photograph of this kind of protest march.
Yeah, it's one of the most, along with the other photo you mentioned, it's the two most striking photos, I thought, in the whole book. Yeah.
Democratic National Convention protests, they tried to do this Japanese protest march, the snake dance, and they even said washoi, washoi, which is what Japanese people say when they're carrying festival floats and also when they do this snake dance, but they failed. They weren't able to do it. They weren't able to match their steps the way that Japanese protesters were, and they crashed into each other. But people were watching this protest march on newsreels and on television, and so I kind of want to write an article as sort of transnational history of the snake dance, its rise and fall. Of course, it ends up dying out in Japan right after 1960 because it's put on a list of banned protest marches that the police will no longer tolerate. And the police, as I describe in the last chapter of my book, develop a method of crushing the snake, crushing the life out of the snake. So that's on the horizon in the more immediate horizon. Longer term, I have a larger book project that I want to work on. And I've already done a significant amount of research for. It's quite a maybe too large project, and I might need to narrow it down a bit, but it's on, it would be a history on discourses on suicide and self-sacrifice in modern Japan from the Meiji Restoration up to the present. And basically the question that's driving that research is nowadays, it's sort of conventional wisdom. Everyone agrees that Japanese people commit far more suicide than other people, or they're more willing to or more easily succumb to committing suicide. And this is in mainstream publications in the West, even to this day, but also in Japan. And so people both in Japan and outside of Japan believe this. And empirically, I think it's relatively easy to show that this is not the case, that if anything, Japanese people probably commit less suicide than people in other countries. And so I'm really interested in the process by which this comes to be conventional wisdom and how it gets tied up with all these tropes about Japanese culture and the essentialization of Japanese culture, kamikaze, samurai committing harakiri or seppuku. But I think this is a really recent process. And even if you go into the pre-war, you can find Japanese government officials who are very proud to say, we Japanese commit less suicide than people in France, for example. And so we have this notion that maybe in the pre-war was all about sacrificing yourself or committing suicide. But that was really, I think, limited to a military context. And it's more in the post-war that this gets extended to all Japanese people. And so I want to look at the historical process of this change in Japanese self-perception of themselves as a people who commit suicide. That's where they end up. And then how this is sort of adopted by the West as well.
Well, thank you so much for that. I'm looking forward to reading both articles, and hopefully we'll have you back on the podcast with the new book in less than 10 years. But again, thank you so much for your time today. I really appreciate it, and take care.
My pleasure. Thank you so much, Nathan.